This is Lee Wilkins, your co-host with Thinking Out Loud, and today we're going to have the first of two conversations with Columbia mayoral candidates. We're taking the whole time this week to talk about a major issue in Columbia that's difficult to do in sound bites, so we're going to try 26 minutes instead. I'm here in the KBIA studios with Columbia's current mayor, Brian Treese. Mayor Treese, welcome to Thinking Out Loud.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back to KBIA.
Okay, well, we really appreciate you taking the time. So I want to start a little bit with something that you were quoted as saying when you ran in for mayor in 2016, which was that you thought over the next three decades or so, Columbia was going to about double in size.
Yeah.
That's a lot of growth. That's a lot of fast growth. You've been mayor now for just a bit. You want to get out your crystal ball again and talk to us about what you see, say, 30 years in the future?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're well on track towards that goal. You know, Columbia is one of the fastest growing communities, not only in the state but in the region. Certainly, in terms of job growth, we've added over 1,076 new jobs with a capital investment of $326 million. We have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country at 1.6%. By any measurement, we are the fastest growing metropolitan area in the state of Missouri to grow jobs at a faster rate than the country as a whole. And all of that greatness makes us a very attractive place to live and work. We have a number of college students that come to Columbia like I did and never leave. And 33 years later, here I am. And I think 30 years from now, we will continue this same trajectory. But that places a lot of demands and challenges, both on how we manage that growth, how we prepare for that growth, how we invest in an aging infrastructure that not only accommodates what we have today, but that peak demand.
So you mentioned that you came to Columbia when you were a college student. If my research is correct, that was sometime in the early 1990s.
It was 1987.
Okay. And downtown's changed an awful lot since then. So I want to start with the parts of growth that it's harder to see, basically infrastructure.
Yeah, let's
issues.
Look at what's below ground. And, you know, one of the reasons that I ran 3 years ago was because everything that we all knew and loved about downtown Columbia, the things that I fell in love with here in 1987 and 1990 when you moved here, was under threat. And we had this unlimited open zoning called C1 zoning and a massive influx of, let's face it, student apartments with no concomitant demand or requirement for parking or even infrastructure costs. One of the big propellants for my campaign 3 years ago was to manage that growth better because, you know, taxpayers were on the hook to provide a 12-inch sewer main and they were paying 75% of the cost while the developer who was creating the demand was paying 25% of the cost.
And meantime, some things have changed at the university. Those 35,000 students have now become more like 30. I think there are some questions about what the occupancy rate of many of those apartments is, not just the ones that are downtown, but also the ones that are sort of built on the outer parts of downtown near Grindstone and wherever, which was where a lot of that original development happened. So what are the things that the city can do to manage that and to say 20 years on down when everybody's paid off their loans and all of a sudden then those buildings have a different sort of financial impetus, if you would?
That's right. And one of the first things that I did was ask for a moratorium on multi-level high-rise student-oriented apartments. We did that within the first 3 months of my swearing in. And I think that gave the private sector, and thank God we did, and when you look at the dip in student enrollment at the University of Missouri, it allowed the market to catch up with that reality. This is highly subsidized student housing. This is not like regular consumers on the open market with their own checkbook. A lot of times they're using mom and dad's money or federal student guaranteed loans coming in and renting these $900 per bed, four-bedroom, four-bath apartments with granite countertops and stainless steel appliances. For us to be able to let the market catch up with itself was a good thing because that allowed us to do the next thing, and that was to pass the first major reform of Columbia's outdated Euclidean zoning code for the first time in 40 years. And we adopted a more unified development code that encouraged infill development, but also created, a sufficiency of services test that force the developer to pay for the water and sewer and parking spots for the demand that was being created.
So when this development was originally planned and a lot of it built, we still have a lot of stress, as I understand it, on our current sewer system. And parking downtown can be an adventure, especially if you're going to something like True Falls. So I'm curious where the city thinks that it is in terms of satisfying either what might be unmet demand, but is certainly an aging sewer system with a lot of stresses and strains.
Well, you know, and from your listener's perspective, the previous city council had prioritized those infrastructure investments, primarily sewer and water and electrical grid, in that rapidly growing downtown area at the expense of the surrounding neighborhoods. And, you know, it's those neighborhoods that have been waiting, you know, for 10 years to get their sewer projects fulfilled. It was one of the reasons I voted against extending the Henderson Branch, the so-called Henderson Branch sewer project, out to Midway, because I didn't think it was fair for us to spend our city's taxpayers and ratepayers' debt dollars to extend a $4 million sewer line outside the city limits when we're not taking care of what we have. I think we need to take care of what we have with what we have before we bite off more than we can chew.
So in other urban settings, when we talk about downtown neighborhoods or more urban neighborhoods, those can be a euphemism for a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to unpack that a little bit and say those are the places in Columbia where people of color generally mm-hmm. live. And certainly those are the places in Columbia where we have what I would at least characterize as somewhat more affordable housing. Mm-hmm. You've said that you believe Columbia is going to grow. So how are we going to balance that growth with the need for infrastructure and at the same time acknowledge that this little problem that we may have is not so little problem when you look nationally about how do we make sure that everybody has a decent place to live?
Well, making our economy work for everyone was one of the promises in my campaign 3 years ago. And I think we've done that. You know, this new zoning reform really encourages the type of infill development, the walkability and bikeability and livability types of communities that we want, so that we're not just building, you know, student-centric apartments, but we're making downtown and all of the surrounding areas eclectic enough that it encourages a wide mix of socioeconomic and demographic factors in a way that are affordable and accessible to people. You know, I was fortunate enough to be able to buy my first home when I was 19 years old, and I was a sophomore in college. And, you know, to do that requires a lot of things. You need an inventory of affordable homes. I paid $25,000 for that first house. You also need willing lenders. And, you know, let's face it, someone that doesn't look like me walking into that bank without two parents to co-sign a loan probably would have gotten a much different reaction from that banker than I did 25, 30 years ago. And then you also need the consumer confidence to know that buying a house, even if your payment is $400 a month for 30 years, is still a lot cheaper than a 12-month lease for $900 a month. And so I think it's a combination of things, because we want to encourage that type of equity, and financial stability. That's also good for the stability of our neighborhoods.
So when you say people who look like you, I'm going to put a little bit of pressure on this, not necessarily on you personally, but on us as a society. Yeah. Columbia is in many ways an economically segregated city. And some of that segregation, if you look at it, it's racially based. So when we're talking about growing, how can we sort of address that problem at the same time?
Well, I've tried to address it with the lens of history, but also to incorporate that decision-making and let that equity permeate everything that we do in our decision-making process. And, you know, I look back at, and the Missourian did a great story about this several years ago, where they walked down one end of Garth Avenue all the way to the north end of Garth Avenue. And they were able to show that you had primarily white owner-occupied homes in the terminus, southern terminus end of Garth Avenue. And when you got to the middle spot where Columbia was founded, there near the water tower, you had more rental occupied. But worse than that, a lot of that housing had been undernourished when it came to public investments. Like, there was no running water when those houses were built, and certainly no indoor sewer connections when those houses were built. And then as it proceeded to go north, you got back into some more of the owner-occupied affordable housing. You know, in that same neighborhood, we talk about systemic racism. You know, you often wonder when you go down Edgewood Avenue, and then when you cross Broadway, it turns to Aldea, and when you cross the next street, it turns into Alexander. That was to connote when you were leaving the white part of the neighborhood into a lesser part of the neighborhood, so that you weren't confused with those people that lived on Edgewood versus the good people that lived on Edgewood. And, you know, it's that type of decision-making and I would say systemic and institutional racism that colored, if you will, our planning and zoning decisions for years. You look at the profound bend in Providence Road. It would have aligned better to I-70 if you went down 4th Avenue, but that was populated with Queen Anne and Victorian homes that would be too expensive to take. But if we could take these poor African-American slums, we could do it at much less cost and develop this road and clean up their neighborhood while we were at it.
So downtown Columbia is in many ways, I think, trying very hard to become walkable.
Yeah.
But if you live in suburban Columbia, okay, when we first lived here, we lived near the intersection of Fairview and Chapel Hill, okay? And that was before the Hy-Vee there was built. I couldn't have walked to a grocery store. I couldn't have walked to medical care. Our daughter could walk to elementary school. So of course, like all good parents, I drove her. But I guess my point is that we've got this one walkable neighborhood, but part of how Columbia grows would seem to me to be to have or to begin to plan for other neighborhoods that are almost as walkable, if you will, for at least residential purposes.
Fairview and Chapel Hill, so named because of the chapel that sits on the hill that had a fair view of the valley. Mm-hmm. But you're exactly right. In that location, we have, you know, wide pedways and sidewalks and a trailhead right there that allows you to access that. We just completed the last approval for a leg of trail that will then complete a 30-mile loop around Columbia. Some of the newer trails are even paved that allow them to be a little more workplace friendly in terms of getting to work accessible. It's one of those really first-class amenities that are often found only in larger cities that I think businesses find very attractive here. The council just approved really the first major infill development under that new unified development code for the first time at the end of Scott Boulevard and Rollins, approximately about 40 acres. That was always zoned commercial, but has the potential there to be senior living, buffer zones of residential multifamily, and then potentially a grocery store, dry cleaners, coffee shop, insurance office, those types of accessible, walkable, hopefully neighborhood-friendly amenities that this Unified Development Code really envisioned. And I think that type of aspirational development is what we should encourage, that has that type of neighborhood interconnectivity.
So one of the things that's going on a few miles away from us is St. Louis City is now talking about becoming St. Louis City and County, if you will, of sort of, and there are lots of reasons for doing that. But one of my questions is, if Columbia grows and grows at the rate that you anticipate, that puts a strain on not just our infrastructure, but it involves our schools. It certainly is going to, in one way or another, involve Boone County.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious as to how you think the city can or should cooperate / lead / follow, however you want to say it, with those entities that have a whole lot to do with the quality of life that people do seem to find here.
I agree. And, you know, the city will probably always be the leader. We work every day with our colleagues at Boone County when it comes to economic development projects and creating, you know, good jobs. And our law enforcement community works together because we know crime doesn't stop at the city limits and vice versa. Or major infrastructure projects like, Scott Boulevard extension, which was a combination of city, county, and state resources to complete that. I think, because we always have 85% of the population and probably more than 85% of the tax base that's generated there will always be a leader in that effort. I'd like to see the school district site their buildings in a way that encourages more walkability and bikeability there instead of using it as a mechanism to drive further growth. I mean, you look at Battle High School, it's a beautiful campus that rivals any community college. We'll have another one, another middle school down Sinclair Road. Problem is, that's a two-lane road with no shoulders and no sidewalks, and the infrastructure costs of building that transportation network and then the housing development that will spring up around that school because there's a school there really puts a lot of strain on our services at the city level.
Have you thought about doing some sort of a joint task force or joint advisory group, either with the schools or with the county, to sort of, if not get ahead of these issues, at least get abreast of them so we would be talking about these things?
I think we do that better now than we did 3 years ago. There's a quarterly meeting between the city and the county and the school district and the university. They're more informal conversations than they are joint planning sessions. I do know that the school district and our community development department work closely on those types of sitings. And, you know, it's a balancing act between the taxpayers' expectations that government is government is government and all tax dollars are tax dollars and we should work closely together, balanced with how do we treat that school district as a potential developer who is creating additional demand for our system without paying for it. And I think, you know, taxpayers are going to pay for it one way or the other, and it would be much better to coordinate that on the front end.
So you've mentioned the three-letter word several times. That would be tax. And I think that is when people hear the word development, they think of a couple of things, but among them is, what is this going to do to my tax bill, which in some ways is kind of connected to, at least in many parts of Columbia, what is this going to do to property values? So as you foresee Columbia growing, how am I, the residential property owner, going to help pay for this? Because I don't think I'm going to get off scot-free.
Well, you know, look, in an ideal world with a well-balanced revenue mechanism, the city collects, or government, for lack of a better, the amorphous government term, collects taxes in a couple of different ways. Property taxes, sales taxes, and user fees. In an ideal world, if that was well balanced, as our population continues to grow and has grown and over the years, then as we add more residents with more homes that purchase more goods and services, then our property tax base should be growing proportionately, our sales tax base should be growing proportionately, and the connection fees to connect to the generational legacy assets of our sewer system and water treatment plant and electrical grid should all pay for itself. But guess what? It doesn't. Growth doesn't pay for itself. And so one of those mechanisms is out of whack. And what we're trying to do now is really study what is an appropriate connection fee to recover the investment that you and I have already made in our homes, paying our utility bills for the last 30 years. I led the effort to defeat a property tax increase without a public vote because I thought it eroded public trust, and it was probably forfeited the opportunity to have a more authentic civic engagement about the need for some type of tax increase to fund either public safety or the street repair, which are the number one and two and sometimes two and one priorities that voters tell us they want their city government to focus on.
So I'm going to peel a couple of layers off of that onion a little bit. And in one way, it seems like you're saying that if Columbia is going to grow, the developers need to pay, if not a large percentage, at least half or 50%. And then property owners, business owners, whatever, also need to pay. Am I misinterpreting what you're saying there?
Not necessarily, although I want to put a finer point on it. There are policies that can encourage the type of growth where we want it. And that's why we have what's called an urban service area, where we have the investment already in place and then sometimes paid off, and we're just doing the cost of service maintenance on our water and sewer and electrical grid. And when you build within that urban service area, your fees ought to be less than when you are building outside that urban service area where we have to extend that sewer line or replace a 9-inch main with a 12-inch main or where we have to add additional power capacity or another substation. That all has to be recovered. And again, that system has to be in balance so that that new homes are both affordable, but that, you know, and look, we can call them developer fees, but at some point they get passed on to the consumer.
Indeed.
In the forms of higher lot prices, higher purchase prices, higher cost, you know, to purchase that home. And at the same time, we want to keep Columbia an attractive place and an affordable place to live and work.
So a couple of other things are important to Columbia, at least I think they are. One of them is I-70, which we don't talk a lot about. The other is the airport, which we have talked more about. But in both instances, it seems to me that that's a place where the city cannot do it all by itself.
No, and in fact, and I'll take both of those first. The about 2 months ago, MoDOT asked for a meeting. Missouri Department of Transportation asked for a meeting and informed the city and the city informed the mayor and the city manager that the I-70 bridge was failing and needed to be replaced. And they had $18 to $22 million to do a rehab project of that,
which would pay for about 1 foot.
It would back up traffic for 40 miles, approximately 8 hours a day for 9 months. The other option, they said, was a complete replacement for $238 million. And would the city help us? Now, as I've just said, I'm not too keen, as you know, on sending city tax dollars outside the city limits. And so I did not get to yes easily. But when I considered the economic impact of the city of Columbia sitting on a cul-de-sac for 9 months, when I looked at the tourism impact of $80 million not coming to the city of Columbia because people won't be able to get to an SEC football game or a Roots and Blues festival or a True False Film Festival because I-70 Bridge is shut down, when I called the president of MU Healthcare and he said there's 14,000 patients from 25 county area that comes to the University of Missouri Healthcare System for its primary care diagnosis, that's not the best patient care model, and ultimately those trauma cases are all going to go to Kansas City or St. Louis, not to mention the inbound and outbound freight that is not going to get to and from Columbia, and we quickly moved to support that symbolically and financially with a $2 million commitment for a total replacement bridge. We'll hear about that in later this fall, but I think that's one of those catalytic infrastructure projects of, you know, on one hand, if we do the short-term fix, we're going to lose economically. On the other hand, if we make this investment and we could benefit from a $200 million infrastructure project for a two-year period with, you know, highly skilled, highly paid construction workers coming here, staying in our hotels, eating at our restaurants, moving their families here for 2 years. And I think that's a very attractive alternative. You know, on the airport, we have a voter-approved terminal in place that was approved in August of my first year in the mayor's office. We're waiting, hopefully in the next couple weeks, for the FAA to approve our terminal area master plan, and we'll begin the bid and design and construction documents to move forward with that new airport terminal. You know, when that airport terminal was built in the 70s, the average enplanement every year was about 40,000 enplanements. We're now up to about 140,000 a year with four direct flights, two to Chicago, two to Dallas, one to Denver every day. We've got four planes that leave within 40 minutes every morning, and we've stretched that terminal to its capacity, and that's probably the next, transportation, but I would also say economic development engine that that we'll have to invest in.
I know there are a number of people in Columbia who love this community as it was in the 50s and as it was in the 60s and as it was in the 70s, long time before you and I got here. How do you respond to those folks who say this is too much growth, it's too fast, it is going to alter the character of the city in such consequential ways that it's not going to be the Columbia I know and love?
Well, and look, no one appreciates that more than me. As a former chair of the Historic Preservation Commission, I've tried to protect those assets that that tell our story and that tell our history in a new and compelling way. We're celebrating our bicentennial in the next couple years, and I've appointed a bicentennial commission to help interpret that shared history from the very beginning. I dare say that General Richard Gentry, when he founded the village of Smithton and then moved it down to the banks of Flat Branch Creek, would have ever thought that Columbia would be alive and well and thriving in the way that it is. But guess what? They really envisioned that. If you look at where the Boone's Lick Trail came down Broadway and then eventually became Highway 40 and then, you know, eventually became the Santa Caligon Trail that traveled all the way to Kansas City and then separated off to the Oregon Trail and the California Trail and the Santa Fe Trail, all of those people that migrated west came through Columbia, and guess what? A lot of them stayed. And I think that's a great story. And I think how we manage that growth, how we manage that expectation is our responsibility. And I'm so proud to be mayor of a city that that is leading the way when it comes to resiliency and efficiency and protecting what we know and love.
So part of your career you spent in Jefferson City.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask you sort of the political part of this question. Usually when you grow, you get more political clout. How do you see a bigger Columbia operating in the state in a way that perhaps it can't right now because there simply isn't the population here that we would need?
I think we're always in competition. You know, Columbia's now the fourth largest city in the state. And, you know, we're not just in competition with Springfield and Kansas City and St. Louis. And I work with the mayors of those communities all the time on climate change and low-income housing and, you know, just a plethora of issues. But we're also in competition with cities our size and larger across the country.
Yeah, I think of us being in competition with Lawrence and Champaign-Urbana and
Ann Arbor,
maybe Boulder
and
places like that.
Yeah, and that's why I'm so proud of our economic record of recruiting and attracting businesses here that could go anywhere. But because of our record of openness and being a welcoming city and a diverse city that want to locate their businesses here, we also want to make this an attractive environment for entrepreneurs and startups. And I think that cool vibe that as Columbia likes to think of itself, it really attracts that younger generation. And when you get the younger generation to come here, the rest of the community follows, and you know that's driving our growth too.
Mayor Brian Treese, on behalf of KBIA and the Thinking Out Loud audience, thank you for taking the time out of your day to talk with us about this issue in some little bit more depth. I want to remind our listeners that the election is April the 2nd, and regardless of how you feel about these issues, it's your duty to get out and vote, so please do so. Again, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you.